an oral history interview with Professor Walter Lee Moore, U of L math teacher. My name is Dwayne Cox. Today is December 1st, 1981, and this is the second interview that Dr. Moore and I have had. And we're down to question or topic number four in our list that calls for a discussion of first impressions of the city and the University of Louisville.
Well, when I first saw the city, of course, is when I crossed the river on a ferry boat. And then my wife and I came here and got a room in an apartment. We didn't have to bring in any furniture, only just our clothes and personal belongings. And at that time, I had a conference with President Kent. He assured me that he wanted me as a teacher rather than as a research mathematician, which was very fortunate. I may have mentioned this before, but that I'll mention it again because it was rather important, because that indicates a change in the university from then and now. I suspect at that time I wouldn't have been hired now with the background that I had of no research. I'm pretty sure I couldn't have got a job here. But at that time they wanted a teacher, and I felt pretty good about that. And after conferring with Dr. Kent and Dr. Stevenson, of course, knew me quite well, and so the two of us then constituted the Department of Mathematics, because, as I think I mentioned before, just before I came here, they had taken off the requirement of mathematics for all students. Of course, that immediately made the load much less. And I was here, and in 1929, I was teaching mathematics full-time. And then in 1930, as everybody remembers, we had a depression, and Department of Mathematics had a lowering of the student body, and I saw rather rapidly that I would be on part-time since I was a newcomer. And so, as I may have indicated before, I developed for myself a prior interest in astronomy. And also I worked with other people for several years along that period in developing what is now one of the parts of the university that's rather important, and that is the development of the idea of interdepartmental activity on the part of students. And I was instrumental. In fact, I was on the first committee that was developed, that was appointed to develop the idea of the natural science, a survey of all of the sciences that at that time was required of quite a few of the students. I don't remember whether it was required of all students or not, but certainly it was. And we developed that course along with my teaching in mathematics, which gave me a very busy full-time occupation, which suited me quite well. The mathematics at that time was a traditional one. We went through, had a few students, not many, and taking a master's degree, but most of the time we were teaching elementary mathematics up through senior level in college. I call that elementary because now, as you may know or may have heard, calculus is now being taught in high school. And when I came here, calculus was considered a college subject, and no calculus was ever taught in high school back in that time, as far as I know. I know it wasn't here in Louisville. I don't know about other places. So we had the regular courses, and I found that I enjoyed my work with Dr. Stevenson because he and I really ran the program. I didn't have to follow directions. I could follow my own bent, and he, of course, likewise, he was head of the department, but as far as our relations are concerned, I don't think I could have told whether he was head or I was head or anything.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I just thoroughly enjoyed myself teaching here at the University of Louisville, and made up my mind, which I haven't changed in the least, that here was where I preferred to spend my life. And I did, as you well know. I'm 83 years old and still at the university, although not teaching. Well, anyway, I did the campus at that time was not as well developed physically as it is today. The only buildings that I know were available were the buildings that were left over from the old Reform School,
mm-hmm.
which was here on the campus area. And I know that physically the campus was changed quite frequently by the man who was in charge. I can't remember his name. I don't think it matters too much. But he was constantly changing the things of the campus, putting in new plantings, taking out the old roads. As I may have mentioned it before, the roads on the campus were of cinder block, cinders,
mm-hmm.
and grass wouldn't grow on them, so every once in a while he'd tear up the roads and put dirt back in the place, grow grass where formerly it was a cinder road. And I know we used to laugh about the sidewalks, because almost invariably when they made the sidewalks, they put them down below the soil level, and the result of which, whenever it rained, those sidewalks made a good runoff for the water that came down in the rain on the campus. That has been changed too,
yeah.
in the last few years. Well, anyway, this was my impression of the campus, and where the present buildings and grounds are now. That was lower at that time, and there was a streetcar that ran out here
yeah.
from downtown.
Yeah.
And during the first few years that I was here, there was considerable effort to get soil enough to fill that in.
Mm-hmm.
And these cinder block roads quite frequently went into that
yeah.
area there, and it was filled in. So that that was the kind of impression that I had of the university. Physically, it's a little bit drab, but intellectually, I don't think it was at all, because we had some outstanding men. Some of them I remember. William Clay came in shortly after I did. He is now retired.
Mm-hmm.
Hassel in the English department was outstanding in research as well as teaching. He was a wonderful teacher. And he and I ran a course at one time on the history of science, and we worked together on that. And that was one of the enjoyable times that I had in getting up to the level that he wanted on this history course.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the book that we used, but it was a very good one, I remember, and I learned an awful lot about the development of science through the ages in putting on this course,
mm-hmm.
as well as learning about the different sciences in putting on this other course of the natural sciences. I didn't teach, as it's now done, I didn't teach the course continuously. We taught it as a group.
Mm-hmm.
The man in physics, Dr. Loring, who was the head of the Department of Physics at that time, taught the physical part of the physical sciences. And we had in Dr. Davies, who was head of the biology department.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll notice that these were heads of departments, and it was considered very important to develop this course in
uh-huh.
natural science. And he was in on it. In chemistry, we didn't have the head of the department on that, But we did have a man who was very much interested in developing chemistry for non-chemical majors. And he did a very good job in lecturing on the chemistry part of the course, so that the course was taught by several different people. I don't think we had anybody in from geology as far as I can remember. We may have, but I have forgotten it if we did. But anyway, a student taking that course got a pretty good idea of what these various sciences were like. The first year, I enjoyed the course very much because I was learning. The second year, it became just a little bit old, and by, I think, the third year, then we got to the point where the individual faculty did not attend the course except when they were giving the, the development and giving the lectures. I understand, I don't know how the course is run at the present time, but I understand it's quite different. I think there's one man that, runs the individual courses in natural science. At that time, in the natural science course, I had a student that by the name of James G. Baker, who came out to the University of Louisville intending to major in chemistry. But as a result of my description in natural sciences of the role of mathematics in science and the role also taught the section which had to do with astronomy, and this youngster began interested in astronomy, and by the following year, that was about 1933 or 34, I gave a course in astronomy for a year, divided into two sections. And he took this astronomy course, and I got him interested in the field of optics. And I had a very rare experience. No, it wasn't rare. It happened to me frequently. Of a student who started in on a subject like optics, and at the end of the semester, he knew more optics by far than I did. Because since then, this student has become one of the leading optical designers in the country. And I saw about 10 or 12, 15 years ago, I saw a release from the Army Air Corps giving the citation of this man as very leading in the development of the cameras that were used during World War II. So that I really had this experience that I enjoyed very much of having a student who really, from the little impetus I gave him, went way beyond what I knew and what I could do and so on. And he made a name for himself, and that was especially in his life.
What was his name now?
Baker, by the way, is a baker who, when we first put up a satellite, developed a telescope called the Baker Nunn telescopes, and there were 8 or 10 of them built under his supervision, which were able to follow these satellites that we put up into the outer atmosphere, outer space. And Nunn was the man who developed the mechanics of the telescope, and Baker was the one who developed the optics. I was told by in this letter from the Air Force, which I saw, it wasn't directed to me, but it was directed to Baker, of course, giving a citation. And he had developed a camera 30 inches in diameter, which at, well, I don't remember the altitude, but it was way up high, would be able to detect on the photographic plate electric light wires. It had very fine resolution. And I heard, I wasn't aware of this personally, but I heard that this camera, which is five elements, had five different lenses in it, that Baker built these lenses himself in his own basement because he couldn't get any optical company to do the lens grinding and working with the data that he knew that they should have in order to make the surfaces perform the way they did. And I understand from what I have heard, this is rumor of course, that when he first put these five lenses together, they worked perfectly and he didn't have to do as most professionals did at that time, would put them together and then modify the ones that were necessary in order to have perfect images. Then a letter that I prized very highly, which got burned up in the fire that I had in my house, was a letter from a man who is an editor of the Scientific American. And he and I had corresponded on other things quite a bit. And he wrote this letter to me saying that if I had done nothing else in my career but developed one James G. Baker, I could consider that I was doing a very good job. And that he was one student that was really outstanding in my experience as teaching here at the University of Louisville. I had other good students, but nothing that compared to him at all as far as mathematics. He was very good in mathematics, by the way, but his mathematics was mainly in developing the theory of optics and the theory of surfaces that were necessary in order to perform certain optical efforts that he wanted this thing to make. So through the years then, I saw mathematics gradually growing, and at one time, I can't remember the years, but at one time we had as high as four faculty in the department. But for a long, long while, many years, 10 decades or so, we just had the two of us. And I had an office in the administration building up in on the upper floor, about where the man who is now, I think, named Garfinkel.
Yeah.
I had the office where he is, and when we had a president pro tem by the name of, he was a lawyer.
Graham.
Brown. And he decided that these rooms were going to be used for administrative purposes, so I was moved into what at that time was a temporary set of buildings, one of which housed the student center and housed the offices that the mathematics department had in this temporary structure. And I can remember, which was probably one of the saddest days of my life at the university, you ask about that in these programs, I can remember that I had the office which was next to the student center, and they had one of these music boxes on the other side of the wall. And of course these temporary structures were built by the Navy in the World War II, and the walls were very thin. And I finally was able to persuade them to move the machine because it was almost impossible to hear myself talking to students or hear them talking to me with this music blaring forth as it did almost constantly. So this is one of the times when I was tempted to leave the university, but I didn't yield to the temptation because my teaching was still enjoyable and not having any trouble, but I certainly didn't like that office. And then I moved when they built the new National Science Building, which was built, I don't remember the date, but you probably have it here in the archives. They built that building, and we moved into the National Science Building, and I had an office there until physics grew so fast that they needed those offices, and then we were moved, I don't remember where, but we were moved somewhere, and out of those offices, and we finally wound up. And at the time I retired, the math department was moved over into the Reynolds building, which was across the street from 3rd Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I was glad at that time that I had... Oh, no, we were moved into... I don't know what the building is called now, but it was on Brook Street. We had offices in that
mm-hmm.
for a while. Where they then the police department went in there. You may know where that is.
Yeah.
And that of course they moved out of there now. They've got another building that they're using. But we had offices there, and then we moved over to the Reynolds building about the time that I retired.
So y'all moved. So, the math department moved around some then.
Yeah, we moved around quite a bit, and I understand they're still in the process of moving because they moved, after my time, they moved from the Reynolds building over into the Naval Science Building when it was discontinued by the Navy at that time.
You had come here in the math department in 1929.
That's right.
And I believe that one of your predecessors, Dr. Siff, had committed suicide in 1926.
That's right.
And then there was another man in the math department, Mr. Hill. Mr. Hill, who was appointed by President Colvin. I just wondered if you remembered or if you heard anything about those two men.
I knew Hill very well because he was still a professor of mathematics. I think this is on the other tape, as far as I know. But Mr. Hill came here, I think, under Mr. Colvin, I believe.
Yeah.
And he came to take the place of Mr. Siff, who had committed suicide. And Hill found that teaching the College of Mathematics was a little bit beyond him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very glad when they appointed him to become
a registrar.
And he made a good registrar, but he made a horrible professor of mathematics, I'm afraid.
Let me just...
I knew him quite well, and he knew me, of course. And we never had any trouble because he wasn't at all... jealous of my taking over the department that he was teaching. I took over some of the courses that he'd been teaching before. Not during his term, of course. I started in 1929. He left in 1928. Math department
went into
registrar's office. And that's how, as I told you once before, I think, that's how I got to be here.
Yeah.
Because Dr. Stevenson needed another math teacher.
There were... I don't know if this is true or not. I don't know if this is true or not, but at the time that he was appointed to the math department, the time Mr. Hill was appointed to the math department, there were people who didn't like President Colvin.
That's right.
Who said that President Colvin appointed Mr. Hill because he was a friend of his.
That's right. Hill was a former
teacher
in high school, and he was appointed at the university by Caldwell, who, as you say, was a friend of his.
So you as far as you know, that was true.
That's true.
Yeah, I think.
I'm pretty sure it's true. And as soon as Hill took over the registrar, then there was a vacancy, and of course, Dr. Stevenson remembered his former roommate in St. Illinois. And as I indicated in the last program that we talked about, that Dr. Townsend at the University of Illinois had told me I could stay there 2 years, but I only stayed one because I had a feeling, as I indicated in the previous thing, that my forte was not in research, but rather in teaching. And I was very careful not to call myself a mathematician. I was a mathematics teacher, which is a great difference, actually.
Yeah.
Because mathematics is a little bit like sculpture and painting and poetry and music. in that was, I think, developed by people who had very active imaginations. And the new development in mathematics which came about was developed by those people.
Uh-huh.
Now, you ask, I think, something about the new math, and I think I can comment a little bit on that. The new math grew out of the development in computers.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first started teaching, we never worried about number systems or any other base except 10.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's the base that was necessary because people counted on their fingers. And since we had 8 fingers and 2 thumbs, well, that made up the 10, and I'm sure that's where the 10 base came from our 2 fingers, 2 hands. And but with the advent of the computer, and I would like to point this out, that there was a mathematician who really developed this, a fellow by the name of von Neumann, who was an exceedingly active mathematician in terms of research. And he developed a mathematics which was already in existence, but he developed it for use of the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you may know, a computer, even the most complicated ones, can only do 2 things, actually. It can turn off a current or turn on a current. That's all they can do. Now, the way they do it, of course, and the development of patterns of turning on and off, is what makes the computer, the present-day computer, possible.
Mm-hmm.
And von Neumann saw that this was going to happen. And so it became necessary to use a mathematics which was developed about a couple hundred years ago. It was necessary to develop a mathematics which is on the base 2.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, all you really did was count 1, and then 1-0 was 2, then 1-1 was 3,
mm-hmm.
and 1-0-0 was 4, and so on. And here you'll notice you only have numbers 1 and 0. Now, a 1, as I understand it now, I don't know what it was then because I really wasn't interested in this at that time, but have been since, the 1 now is a voltage about 5 volts, and the 0 is a 0 voltage. So that if you change the voltage from 0 to 5, you can get a machine to do counting, and by working with these patterns that I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
you can also get them to recognize forms, and numbers can be used to stand for letters, for example, from 1 to 26. You can use those numbers instead of letters. So that was possible then to, and I'm sure that von Neumann was the one who did the major development on this back in the days when we used tubes for radio communication. And I don't think I'd better go into that because for 2 reasons. One, it's too long, and the other is I don't know too much about it. That's reason enough, I think, not to carry on the discussion any further. But this was the way in which these computers were developed, by recognizing, or rather putting numbers into patterns, and then getting a circuit which would recognize the patterns that were developed. And when it did, of course, you could store these patterns in the machines and then bring them out, and you could get back what was you stored. The storing was done 2 ways. One, by changing the voltage from 5 to 0. The other way to do it was to change a magnet, which, by the way, has only 2 poles, the north pole and the south pole. And the north...